You've reached Voicemails from History. You have one new message. On Lemkin's account of an exchange with one professor, the argument escalated into a grand epiphanic moment. Lemkin asked, "Did the Armenians ever try to have the Turk arrested for the massacre?" The professor responded, "There wasn't any law under which he could have been arrested." "Not even though he had a part in killing so many people," Lemkin countered. "Let us take the case of a man who owns some chickens," the professor replies. "He kills them. Why not? It's not your business. If you interfere, it's trespass." "The Armenians were not chickens," Lemkin said sharply. The professor allowed the youthful comment to pass. He said, "When you interfere with the internal affairs of a country, you infringe upon that country's sovereignty. So, it's a crime for Tehrillerian to strike down one man, but not a crime for that man to have struck down 1 million men?" Lemkin asked. The professor shrugged. Welcome to episode 1 of the Voicemails from History podcast. I'm your host, Mujtah Amin, and in this episode we're going to be discussing the historical development of the legal terms genocide and crimes against humanity. These were the legal concepts used for the first time during the Nuremberg trials of 1945, an event which has gained a sort of mythological status in the Western imagination. I'd like to discuss how the personal stories behind these ideas were formulated amidst the turmoil and horrors of the Second World War. To guide me, I'll be using what I think is a brilliant book called East West Street by Philip Sands, which I actually read during Lockdown 1, but I felt that considering the constant conversations we have in politics or in social issues regarding human rights and laws, I thought it would be apt to just dive right in. So in the book, Sands focuses on Central/Eastern Europe, which is nicknamed by another historian as being the bloodlands of the 20th century Europe. Sands explores a borderland city which changed names no less than 7 times between 1914 to 1945. From this otherwise not well-known city, 3 key historical individuals emerged. In turn, all 3 of them, in their very different ways, impacted the Nuremberg trials, the first time a European country's various heads of state were put on trial, convicted, and punished, the so-called birth of our international justice system. To start off, just as a brief sort of disclaimer/review, the book East West Street is quite genre-defying, and it's a successful mix of personal family history involving a lot of impressive detective work, legal talk, wider historical talk, and then legal philosophical reflection. So the book isn't what we would call a strict history sort of scholarly monograph, but actually I think that with the author's background as an international human rights lawyer and scholar, and how deeply his own family were involved in the tragedies of World War II, that his writing and discoveries add an intimate insight into this troubled period in European history. So, what were the Nuremberg trials? So, these were a number of tribunals or legal courts where the victorious Allied forces of World War II, so the US, Britain, France, and Soviet Russia, decided to put the remaining defeated German Nazi leaders or figureheads on trial for crimes committed during the war. Now, quite a few of the leading Nazis had already managed to commit suicide before they were arrested. So notably, Joseph Goebbels, who was the propaganda minister, Himmler, who was head of the German police, and SS. Another important one, Eichmann, actually managed to sort of have this very bizarre escape to South America. And he managed to actually stay in hiding until 1960. I think they found him in Argentina. And then he was put on trial in Jerusalem by the Israeli forces in a widely televised trial and then later hanged in 1962. But anyway, back to 1945, the remaining key Nazis that the Allies managed to round up numbered around 21, all leading figures in the Nazi regime. And the notable one for us, and this book in particular, was Hans Frank, who became the Governor General of Nazi-occupied Poland. So this brings us to the individuals and the city in question. And the hook of this book rests on this really strange coincidental relationship that these 3 leading men had with this one city. So, from the 19th century, the city, called Lemberg, was located on the edge of the Austria-Hungarian Empire. This was an empire where the two monarchies from Austria and Hungary had united into one. The empire ruled over no less than about 11 to 12 ethnic groups, approximately 51 million people. Now, following Austria-Hungary's collapse in World War I, Poland emerged as an independent nation-state, and it was renamed from Lemberg to Lwów. Then, following the Soviet Union's occupation at the outbreak of World War II, the Soviets renamed it Lwów. Then, when the Nazis renegaded on their promise or pact to not attack the Soviet Union, they did just that, they took over, and they switched it back to Lemberg. Then, the Soviets pushed back and took control again during World War II, and it was absorbed into the state of Ukraine and named, or renamed even, Lviv in 1944. The name it still has today, an ostensibly Ukrainian city. So this border city, at the crossroads of Europe geographically and ideologically, became the city which our three key individuals either lived in, studied in, or impacted. And it's quite a fascinating microcosm of how larger issues or political forces, in this case fascism versus communism, impacted the lives of millions of people. Our three individuals never actually met each other, but they all affected each other in the most direct and intimate of ways. So the first guy is called Hirsch Lauterpacht. He was a lawyer of Jewish origin who formulated the legal term crimes against humanity, which was encoded into the Nuremberg verdicts. The second guy, Raphael Lemkin, was also a lawyer, also of Jewish origin, who formulated the legal term genocide, which was also encoded into Nuremberg. And finally, our third guy is called Hans Frank, also a lawyer, a Nazi. He was actually one of Hitler's personal lawyers who ended up taking over Poland, approximately 11.5 million citizens at the time, including Lviv. So how did they affect each other? Well, Hans Frank was responsible for the elimination of their family members and loved ones. And when the war would come to an end, Lauterpacht and Lemkin would in turn ensure that their legal philosophies would be the ones that would prosecute Hans Frank and ultimately lead to him hanging in 1946. So what I'd like to do is explore how these three men arrived or tried to formulate their legal philosophies. And I'll refer back to the voicemail. What are the differences between the legal concepts of crimes against humanity versus genocide? And then lastly, what are some of the implications of this legal framework that we still have to this day, considering their historical origin? So, an important note to understand is that before 1945, sovereignty, which means to have and then enact power, was confined to the internal affairs of each nation state. Now, there had been previous steps sort of taken before 1945 on the issue of humanitarian law. So, for example, the Hague Convention was set up in 1907, and this was the first international agreement outlining the basic rules for warfare. And among the rules were the prohibitions of mistreating your prisoners of war, as well as protecting the lives of civilians. There was also the League of Nations set up in 1924, but nowadays people tend to agree that it was particularly useless and defunct as it lacked that binding nature that it needed. And so when it came down to the realities of how states and governments behaved, there was quite a steadfast belief that sovereignty was absolute, meaning that they could do as they wished. The right for a nation state to have complete sovereignty overruled humanitarian ideas for the rights of the individuals or the groups. Now, there's a period called the long 19th century between 1789 to 1914, which some historians have pinpointed as being this great age of modern nationalism, at least nationalism in a 20th century understanding of it. So where people within their borders place great pride or devotion to that country. And in terms of looking at the causes of conflict, like World War I and II, nationalism definitely played its part. So whether it manifested itself as patriotism combined with militarism, or when nationalism takes on an ethnic colour and becomes xenophobic, then it becomes fascism. And in Germany, the fascism that emerged turned into Nazism. So let's look at our first guy then, Hans Frank. So Hans Frank was a lawyer by profession, and he was everything that one would expect in a top-ranking Nazi minister. So before joining the Nazi Party in 1920, he was involved in various groups, such as the anti-communist or of an anti-Semitic nature. Now, as a lawyer, he took the route of defending Nazi Party members in various trials before, obviously, the Nazis came into power. And on one occasion, he used Hitler as a witness. So from that, they were able to forge a bond, they got to know each other, and he ascended into the higher ranks of the regime. Importantly, Hans Frank tried to set about an intellectual explanation for Nazism's end goals. So, in one speech in the book, he outlines the following. The first thing is that Germany as a nation and Hitler were one, that they were intertwined. The second thing was that Germany could and should rule freely. So the idea of outside interference of international agreements was completely anathema to Nazism. Obviously, trying to tell Hitler what to do proved to be a useless gamble, as Britain and France unfortunately got to experience. The third important part of Nazism was its values, all based on the idea of building a national community, and there would be none of what Hans Frank called, quote, individualistic liberal tendencies, end quote. In Nazism, individuality was a dirty word. What there needed to be was a complete submission to the goals of the nation, and that everybody was working for the advancement of this greater Germany that Hitler wanted to create. And finally, underpinning all of this was that the German people had to be cleansed of so-called racial undesirables to ensure their supremacy. Now, the book doesn't go into too much detail, but it is quite common knowledge how the Nazis and other European countries as well used science or pseudoscience as a tool to measure, quite literally, who was racially superior or inferior. And in the strictest sense, the morbid fascination that Western Europe has had, and continues to have, albeit in different ways, saw its full culmination in the Final Solution, the systematic and deliberate plan to exterminate the so-called racially inferior. Now, Poland was chosen by leading Nazis to be the place where this project would all begin. So, why Poland? Hitler's hatred for Eastern Europe underpinned a lot of his racial thinking. The historian Trevor Roper does quite a good job of explaining this. So to achieve world power that sort of Hitler craved required the complete conquest of Russia and the extermination of the Slavs there, and all of that would lead to Germany being able to colonize the East for its own purposes. And this Eastern policy, as it was called, was essential to Nazism. Now, if we compare it to the other side, so for example, Western Europe, for Hitler, the offence of Britain was its refusal to be defeated and be led by him. The offence of Russia was its very existence. So whereas fighting France and Britain was about power and politics, fighting Russia was about exterminating it. And so cities like Lviv, as well as other cities in Poland, were all put through the final sort of stages of the Final Solution. Now, Lviv was a highly multiracial city. It's one of those classic border cities which nation states scratch their heads over. So just in Lviv, the population roughly was split. 50% were about ethnic Poles, 35% Jews, and Ukrainians numbered somewhere around 20%. Now, as the Nazis expanded eastwards, obviously the numbers of Jews also swelled, and they were deported to various regions across Poland. Overseen by Hans Frank, the first step was ghettoisation. The Lviv ghetto was set up in 1941, and we're talking here, by the end of it, around 120,000 Jews were ghettoised in Lviv. The ghetto was then formally liquidated by July 1943, and the majority of the Jews were transported to Belzec extermination camp, as well as many others. Now remember, Lauterpacht was in the UK and Lemkin was in the US. Both were following the news day by day, anxious about what was happening to their families in Lviv. Now by 1942, midway 1942, the idea of an accountability panel, or that justice had to be served, was floating around among the Allied forces. And both of these men, Lemkin and Lauterpacht, wanted to get in on the legal issues of Nuremberg. The Allied countries were conscious of two things. Firstly, that if justice should be served, it had to be done in a new, clear, or sort of a transparent way. And secondly, they were also aware that this was going to be quite a long-term significance, and it was going to impact how we literally view the world for years to come. So in 2021, we still have the UN Charter of Human Rights, and when crises occur, social media and political spheres keep referring back to the UN Charter, a result of the Nuremberg trials. Lauterpacht and Lemkin, both practicing lawyers, wanted to serve justice, but they arrived at two very different legal conclusions, and we'll now discuss the points of debate around these two people. So Lauterpacht, the first one, he grew up in Lviv from the age of 13 onwards. He completed his law degree at the University of Lviv, and it was a combination of his professors and the wider political developments around him that allowed him to come to his own legal conclusions. So in 1918, while he was at university, World War I was slowly coming to an end. However, in Lviv, a bloody conflict ensued between the Poles and the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians, basically what had happened was they had taken over the city and declared it to be a new part of the West Ukrainian Republic. This obviously angered the Poles, and so fighting broke out. The Jews, caught between these two warring groups, tried to stay as neutral as possible. Lauterpacht joined what developed, which were ad hoc Jewish militias whose job was to patrol Jewish neighbourhoods for safeguarding. And this was all while he was at university. At the same time, professors were allowed to choose whether they wanted Ukrainians or Jews to attend their lectures. And so for Lauterpacht, seeing the issues of group or ethnic identity turning to discrimination and bloodshed, it was pretty formative in his legal thinking. How could the law be used properly to protect vulnerable communities? At the same time, there were a few of his professors who were beginning to align themselves with ideas coming in from the USA, so that individuals had rights and that they should be protected by the constitution of their country. This propelled Lauterpacht to focus on the individual, and the key change here was that individuals should not just have national rights, but they should have international rights, and that there should be an international community that should pressurise nations to fulfil their obligations, as in most cases at the time, not all individuals had rights, only certain ones. And so throughout all of this, he finally coined the idea crimes against humanity. And for Lauterpacht, he elevated the individual person, that the person individually should become the focus of the law. Later, on a lecture visit to the US, he became acquainted with the US Attorney General Robert Jackson, who would later become the Chief Prosecutor at Nuremberg. Lauterpacht was invited to give his thoughts on how to proceed, and he put forward his idea of crimes against humanity. At the same time, we have our last guy, Raphael Lemkin. So Lemkin, working in the US, had published a book in 1944 that he titled The Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. And in this, he had coined the term that we all know quite well today, genocide. Now, in contrast to Lauterpacht, Lemkin's approach was to put the group at the heart of the law. And a formative event for Lemkin was the Armenian Genocide of 1915. He had read about the killing of approximately 1.2 million Armenians, and he became quite fixated on the notion of the destruction of whole groups. The significant event for Lemkin was in 1921 in Berlin. A trial was held against a young man, a young Armenian man, called Sahomin Tehlirian. Now, Tehlirian had been put on trial because he had assassinated one of the top Ottoman ministers, Talat Pasha, who was responsible for ordering the Armenian genocide. Now, the defence lawyer played a group identity card, so he argued that Tehlirian was acting in defence, but also as an avenger for his whole village and family who had been massacred. The jury declared him to be not guilty, and it caused quite a flurry of debate in the legal world. Essentially, by declaring that Tehlirian was not guilty, Talat Pasha, the leader and minister, had been posthumously declared to be guilty. And remember, at the time, governments were operating through absolute sovereignty. Now, Lemkin sided with the jury. It wasn't right for that man to have gone free or unpunished, he argued. Surely a line had to be drawn on the state's right to kill its own people. His professors at the time argued against him. sovereignty was absolute, they said. And I wanted to include that debate he had with one of his teachers, as I think it does a really great job of illustrating just how ingrained this mentality was about sovereignty prior to 1945. So then this begs the question, what's the difference between genocide and crimes against humanity? Aren't they both essentially wanting the same thing, which is to protect human beings? So for genocide to make sense as a concept, it needs for people to think of themselves as being part of a group. Critics of genocide, like Lauterpacht, pointed out the issue of biological thinking inherent in the idea. So by making groups the primary focus of law, it doesn't protect, but in fact reinforces the idea that we can be separated into neat or almost neat groups of people. So are you Pole, Ukrainian or Jew first? Are you both? Who decides that for you? And if we place too much emphasis on the group, Lauterpacht argued, could it lead to weakening the conviction that it's already a great crime to kill one individual? And so the thinking behind genocide, critics argue, is that it leads to, or at least it reinforces, racism itself. And in fact, at some point in his book, Lemkin goes on quite a tirade, and he writes, quote, that there was an innate viciousness in the German racial character, end quote. And so Sands makes the point that actually for Lemkin, in trying to protect one group, he blames a whole other in its entirety. And I found that point quite significant because if we think about nowadays, there's sort of a hierarchy that's emerged when it comes to defining what kind of atrocities a government or a group of people have committed. And genocide consistently comes out on top as being sort of the crime of all crimes. I found that debate to be interesting. On the other hand, Lemkin argued back quite persuasively that actually genocide is the right term to use because, practically speaking, he argued that's where the way the world worked. So he said that violence was committed against groups of people. In this case, it was just ethnic or racial. And individuals are targeted because they're part of a larger community, not because they have so-called standalone qualities. And he thought that using genocide was a more practical way of trying to prosecute aggressive people or governments. And so these two men, once residents of Lviv, whose families had perished due to the actions of Hans Frank, came to define the new legal concepts used at the Nuremberg trials. So the trials went on and verdicts were passed. Roughly 200 Nazis were hanged, 300 others were given life imprisonment. And yet people rightly question, was justice truly done? So for example, for many people in Germany at the time, the whole thing was a complete farce for them. It was a classic example of the victors ruling over the defeated. What about the Allied bombings and the firestorms that British planes had created targeting German civilians? What about the aggressive crimes committed by the Red Army against German civilians as well? The rape of Berlin, for instance. And lastly, the US dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the victors definitely did create a justice system in their own name and mould. Yet at the same time, the Nuremberg trials were still groundbreaking in both the short and the long term. So yes, we can level criticism at the Nuremberg trials and the ways that the Allies conducted the whole affair. But at the same time, it's quite hard to imagine the Allies defeating Nazi Germany and then just doing nothing about it, or just allowing these top-ranking Nazis to just, you know, go home or escape. And time again in history, all winning groups have exercised their authority and their control on the losing side. So despite all the issues and flaws that we can level at the Nuremberg trials, they still set an important precedence. No longer could a state act with certainty that their actions will be ignored or accepted even under the guise of so-called absolute sovereignty. And moreover, the results of Nuremberg brought about new interesting challenges as well. So for example, the issue of retroactive justice. So if we take the example of the Armenian genocide, or even further back in time to the massacre of the Nama and Herero peoples of 1904? What about the Bengal famine of 1943? Was that not a crime against humanity? So if the laws were made in 1945, can they go back and apply it to events that occurred prior to the law being made in the first place, and how fair is that? Regardless, time went on, and slowly and surely Europe began to make more moves. So the Genocide Convention was formulated in 1948, followed closely by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And later, the Nuremberg Tribunals were recreated in 2017 for the UN Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia. Another tribunal was set up for Rwanda, which ended in 2016. And importantly, the verdicts from the Rwanda trial officially recognised the use of rape as a means of achieving genocide, which was another legal advance for the international justice system. And then finally, the International Criminal Court, formed in 2002, which has received plenty of praise but also plenty of criticism. We all know that crimes against humanity or genocide or however you want to, you know, codify it in legal terms, they still occur. In the case of Nuremberg, Germany completely capitulated, so it was quite easy for the Allies to hold the trials and exercise their jurisdiction. In some areas of conflict that we have today, jurisdiction is still an issue. So for example, Syria still remains at war. As a result, there have been a number of transnational efforts so far to hold people accountable for what's happened in Syria. So for example, I think about 60 or so high-ranking Syrian officials have so far been charged with various counts, including crimes against humanity. There have been some wins, but otherwise the gears have moved pretty slowly. And what about the other perpetrators involved in Syria? For example, Russia, Iran, Turkey, the Gulf countries. How is justice going to be served there for the millions of people that have died as a result of what these other countries have done in that region? And then the issue becomes even more complicated when we consider other groups, so groups or communities that do not have a nation state that's been clearly demarcated in their name. So he was going to be convicted for various crimes committed against the Kurds, a stateless group, when so many of the perpetrators come from various countries, not just within that region, but also, you know, across Europe as well. So I think when it comes to an area like the Middle East, which is an area I'm interested in, I don't think it's going to be a sort of case of where we can just replicate European-style institutions into that region, because it's so different. Europe 1945 is not the same as the Middle East in 2021. Our lived experience, our different cultures, all the different religions in that region, they're all going to play really decisive roles in shaping what people want for their futures. And going back to the International Criminal Court, there are many countries that still don't recognise its power. So the USA, for instance, Russia, China, India, Israel, and a number of other countries as well, they don't cooperate with the court. And so its power is quite limited, and it depends really on cooperation from various states. And I think that is both its strength and also its weakness. I'm not trying to imply, though, that the International Criminal Court is useless or defunct. Quite the opposite. It's a great system, and people should use it if they feel like it's going to be useful for them. But in terms of long-term thinking here, for countries or people that do want justice, the real work needs to be done in the region that they are from themselves. So the people of that country or area need to think about how do they want to build accountability institutions into the country's infrastructure on their own terms, cooperating with, for example, in this case, the European institutions as well. And the final point I want to make is that reading East West Street drove home for me how intimately and intrinsically European the origins of the word genocide and crimes against humanity are, and the way that they've been used in the legal world. I definitely like to explore in future episodes other historical examples of rights or how authority has been held accountable, and the various paradigms that we do it through. So what kind of values and ideas are dictating the way that we judge people and hold them to account? I hope this episode has given you some food for thought. I would highly recommend that you do read the book that I've been talking about, as I've only touched upon some of the core legal issues, but the book is so much more. So do consider reading it yourself and then let me know what you think of it. Thank you so much for listening to episode 1 of the Voicemails from History podcast.